Well, good evening and welcome. My name is Rosalind Wright. I'm a Yale parent and an Amnesty International volunteer, and we're very gratified to have all of you here this evening. This is a very painful and difficult topic to discuss, but it is an urgent topic to discuss. So we're very happy to have all of you and to have this incredible and distinguished panel to join us who've literally come in from all over the country. Mark Danner from California and Congressman Conyers flew in today from Detroit, and Barbara Oshansky from New York on Amtrak, which we all know is essentially like flying across the country some days. So we're very happy to have them all here. And I'd also like to thank the sponsors of this event. It's the Yale chapter of Amnesty International, that's very ably led by Tiffany Wan and Lana, I'm going to mess up this name, Akayeva, I believe. And also local Amnesty number one. It's, we believe, the first chapter in the country, which is why it carries that designation. And it is led by the wonderful Lisa Carter. So we appreciate all their effort in getting us here tonight. And I would like to start by just sharing an experience with you that I had this week. I've literally spent the last 10 days or so beating the bushes, trying to get people interested and committed to coming out tonight. And we put out a series of flyers, which many of you have probably seen around town or on campus, and it features the very figure you see behind you, who has become the sort of icon of the torture movement, you could say, in the United States, the anti-torture movement. And in the process of this, I sent the flyers to a number of churches, and I got a call back from one of the pastors who said, "We really appreciate the flyer. We'll let the congregation know, but we will not be distributing this flyer. It's far too gruesome and graphic for us to look at." And my reaction to that was that I felt shame. I felt like I had been caught circulating a dirty picture, and to a pastor, no less. And I think it's that sense of shame that really surrounds this issue. And it makes it very difficult to talk about. I've felt that same sense of shame when I have been discussing this with my own children, what our government is doing in my name and in their name. And part of the feeling from shame no doubt comes from the fact that torture all too often involves sexual degradation. And a lot of the images certainly reflect that. But I think the larger part of the shame came from the combination of anger and a feeling of helplessness that has been building in me for the last 3 years as I've read the morning paper and about lives that have been literally snatched off the street, about people who have been brutally hurt, terrorized, sometimes tortured to death, all in the name of keeping me and my family and all of us safe and cushioned, for the most part, from real fear. And I will certainly admit that I have had many a sleepless night worrying about my children's lives in the post-9/11 world. But I would like to comfort myself to believe that these extreme actions that we've heard about and read about and seen taken by our government are, in fact, keeping us more safe. But there are too many compelling arguments to the contrary. And I can't even comfort myself with the certainty that every single man, woman, and child that has been hurt by these actions, it was in fact plotting against us. And you will hear tonight that that is demonstrably not the case. Finally, it would be a comfort at least to believe that the images that we have all seen come from a few rogue people's actions. But we all know that is not the case. There are over 1,800 images that members of Congress were allowed to see that the American public have never been allowed to see. And we can't even count the number of pictures that have never been taken, will never be taken, in places like Guantanamo and Iraq and Afghanistan, and even here in this country in some of our own detention centers. It would certainly be easier just to remain unknowing and look away. But to remain silent as our fellow human beings are stripped of their very humanity would itself be an act. It would be an act which would define us as a people who are unworthy of the heritage of laws and liberty that we have all inherited. We are incredibly fortunate to have with us tonight a man who has the moral courage and the journalistic skill to help Americans both know and understand what is happening in some of the darkest cells in the world. Mark Danner is a professor of journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. He is also the Henry R. Luce Professor of Human Rights and Journalism at Bard College. He is a longtime contributor to The New Yorker and the New York Review of Books, the winner of the National Magazine Award, and he's authored a number of books, including Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror, which was just selected by the Overseas Press Club as the best book of the year on international relations. In 1999, Mark was named a MacArthur Fellow. But more important than any of his awards or his accomplishments is the fact that Mark Danner uses his knowledge, his experience, and his talent to make certain that the truth does come out and to remind each of us as we are confronted with facts and images that are horrifying and deeply shocking that we must respond with full awareness of our responsibility as citizens and the full power of our indignation. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great honor to introduce Mark Danner.
Do I need this?
I don't know. You can try it out.
Thank you very much to Roslyn Wright for organizing this event at such short notice and doing it so well. And thanks to the New Haven chapter of Amnesty International. It's an honor to be here and to be speaking with Barbara Olshansky and Congressman Conyers as well. I was very flattered by that introduction. The theme of it is what I used to believe, which is that the job of the journalist and the writer is to reveal, to bring light to dark places, etc. I think the journalistic profession in general came to that idea during Watergate especially. Revelation of wrongdoing, followed by investigation by the institutions of our government, followed by adjudication, followed by punishment, followed by a return to the state before the crime happened. That is a return, a kind of redemption, or return to the state of grace. This is a traditional idea of what journalists do, you know, the so-called seeker after truth that they flatter themselves as being. But the fact is that very often that's not enough. And we're confronted with a case when we look at the so-called Abu Ghraib scandal, or the torture scandal, where this manifestly is not enough. In fact, the fact is now that we know what has been going on, not only at Abu Ghraib, but at Guantanamo, Bagram Air Base, and a number of other bases and detention places around the world whose names we do not know. We know it because of the documents that we've seen. We know it because of the pictures we've looked at. We know it because of the accounts of the detainees that have been made public and that we have read. And we also know that many of these things are still going on, which is to say that revelation has not been enough. And we are poised at this point in this odd and rather compromising position. Revelation has happened. An investigation, a true investigation, has not really come about, though there have been 10 half investigations, or 9 or 8, depending on how you count. But we have not had an investigation that has the full power of Congress, the full subpoena power of the federal government behind it, an investigation that can look from those events, from the rooms where American soldiers and American intelligence officers put their hands on prisoners and have done things to them that constitute abuse, torture, and a number of other words that I could use tonight. We have not had an investigation that connects those people to the decisions made by policymakers in offices in Washington. and some of the most important, largest, and most prestigious offices in Washington, I should add. So we're poised in a very compromising position. We know, but we are not redeemed. We know, but in a sense, we are all culpable. I wrote a piece about a month ago, I guess, or a little more than that, for the New York Times op-ed page. It was during the hearings for then White House counsel, now Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. And I titled the piece, "We Are All Torturers Now," taking after the Le Monde headline, famous Le Monde headline after 9/11, "We Are All Americans Now." And what I meant by "We Are All Torturers Now," that we are burdened with this knowledge, but we don't have expiation. Because in fact, though some lower level officers, soldiers, have been punished in highly publicized trials, none of the mid-level people have been punished, and none of the officials who actually wrote these policies, and many of the documents we have, you can find them in this book, you can find them on the web, documents drafted in the Department of Justice, the Office of Legal Counsel there, documents drafted in the Department of Defense, many of them made public, not all of them by any means, many of them leaked by officials within the government who were appalled by these policies. But though we have the documents, the officials in all cases are still in the offices that they occupied, or in some cases, for example, the well-known case of Alberto Gonzalez, they have been promoted, in his case, to that the position of the Chief Law Enforcement Officer of the United States. I'd like to take a moment and let the detainees speak. I think one of the interesting things about those photographs, which are part of our minds now, those images, they have a double-sided value, a double-sided force. First, they made it possible for this to be a scandal in the first place. That is, they made this scandal televisual. CBS broadcast it. When the news of the actual investigation broke in January 2004, it was an inside story in the newspaper. Only the pictures, this one, the one of the man with a leash around his neck, the piles of naked bodies, the people chained up to bars and so on, you know all of them. Only those pictures made it possible for this to be a scandal in the first place. But since the original scandal broke, we've seen the pictures take on a second role and an opposite role, which is that they have tended, at least in my view, in their grotesquerie, in their outlandishness, in their sheer disgusting quality, to support the administration line on what actually happened in those rooms and in these places. The administration line is that a few bad apples were responsible for these actions. No one ordered them. They were part of no procedures. They were part of individual sadistic acts by a handful of lower-level soldiers who have now been prosecuted in trials that have been highly publicized. In fact, trials that were moved back here to Fort Hood so they could be publicized. Now, this is the lawyers know this as the few bad apples defense, believe it or not. Governments tend to adopt this when they're accused with torture. The UK, for example, the United Kingdom in the early 70s, there was a famous case called the Five Techniques case in Northern Ireland. They also contended it's a few bad apples. It has nothing to do with policy. And I think that the pictures tend to lend credence to that argument. We look at them and we say, oh my God, you know, look at these things. They must have happened at night at the hands of a few sadists. How could this be government policy? Well, I want to read you the words of a detainee. After these, the pictures were made public and the investigations began, the Criminal Investigation Division of the U.S. military sat down with the detainees who'd been abused and took depositions. All of these are public. Some of them are included in this book. This is the definition. This is the deposition of detainee number 7. And I warn you, it's not very pleasant to hear, but I feel it's important to understand really what we're dealing with here. The first day, they put me in a dark room and started hitting me in the head and stomach and legs. They made me raise my hands and sit on my knees. I was like that for 4 hours. Then the interrogator came, and he was looking at me while they were beating me. Then I stayed in this room for 5 days, naked, with no clothes. They put handcuffs on my hand, and they cuffed me high for 7 or 8 hours. Now, this is called, in the euphemism of torture and interrogation techniques, this is called a stress position. The idea behind this one is to cuff the detainee high enough so that he's either standing on his tiptoes or dangling from the bars. The idea is to put pressure on the shoulder and sometimes pop the arm out of the socket. They put handcuffs on my hands and they cuffed me high for 7 or 8 hours. And that caused a rupture to my right hand, and I had a cut that was bleeding and had pus coming from it. They kept me this way on 24, 25, and 26 October. So that's the way he was left. And in the following days, they also put a bag over my head, in other words, a hood. This is called sensory deprivation in the documents. They put a bag over my head, and of course, the whole time I was without clothes and without anything to sleep on. And one day in November, by the way, in Baghdad's very cold, so he was naked in an unheated cell. And one day in November, they started a different type of punishment, where an American police came to my room and put the bag over my head and cuffed my hands, and he took me out of the room into the hallway. He started beating me, him and 5 other American police. I could see their feet only from under the bag. Beatings are often administered with a hood because it adds to the terror, essentially, because you can't see the blows coming. A couple of those police, they were female because I heard their voices, and I saw 2 of the police that were hitting me before they put the bag over my head. One of them was wearing glasses. I couldn't read his name because he put tape over his name. Some of the things they did were make me sit down like a dog, and they would hold the string from the bag, and they made me bark like a dog, and they were laughing at me. One of the police was telling me to crawl in Arabic, so I crawled on my stomach, and the police were spitting on me when I was crawling and hitting me. Then the police started beating me on my kidneys, and then they hit me on my right ear, and it started bleeding, and I lost consciousness. He loses consciousness several times during this deposition. I'm going to cut it out here. They also tore off his ear most of the way, and the interrogator sewed it back on. A few days before they hit me on my ear, the American police, the guy who wears glasses, he put red women's underwear over my head, and then he tied me to the window that is in the cell with my hands behind my back until I lost consciousness. That's, in other words, tied up like this, again, to put pressure on the shoulders. Also, when I was in room number 1, they told me to lay down on my stomach, and they were jumping from the bed onto my back and my legs. And the other two were spitting on me and calling me names, and they held my hands and legs. After the guy with the glasses got tired, 2 of the American soldiers brought me to the ground and tied my hands to the door while laying down on my stomach. One of the police was pissing on me and laughing at me. And the soldier and his friend told me in a loud voice to lie down, so I did that. And then the policeman was opening my legs. Again, he's naked, obviously, through all this. And then the policeman was opening my legs with a bag over my head, and he sat down between my legs on his knees. And I was looking at him from under the bag, and they wanted to do me because I saw him and he was opening his pants. So I started screaming loudly, and the other police started hitting me with his feet on my neck, and he put his feet on my head so I couldn't scream. And then they put the loudspeaker inside the room, and they closed the door, and he was yelling in the microphone. This is called use of noise to induce stress. They took me to the room, and they signaled me to get on the floor. And one of the police, he put a part of his stick that he always carries inside my ass, and I felt it going inside me about 2 centimeters. And I started screaming. And he pulled it out, and he washed it with water inside the room. And then 2 American girls that were there, he means female soldiers, when they were beating me, they were hitting me with a ball made of sponge on my dick. And when I was tied up in my room, one of the girls with blonde hair, she is white, she was playing with my dick. And they were taking pictures of me during all these instances. Now, when you hear this in its detail, I think the immediate reaction is similar to seeing the pictures. You think, this is so disgusting and over the top, it couldn't really be part of some kind of plan. There's no way officers could know about this and so on. The problem is that when you look at the depositions, one after the other, and the many, many accounts we have of abuse now, from Guantanamo as well, written some of the accounts written by counterintelligence people and counterterrorism people from the FBI and elsewhere, and these legal depositions taken by the U.S. Army, you see patterns. you see that actually the activity depicted is similar. And you, what are the patterns? Well, prolonged beatings, first of all, but also sexual humiliation, violation, sexual violation, very often with a stick or a chemical light in one case, a police baton in this case, threats of rape, forced humiliation using women's underwear, forced nakedness. The idea behind it is, again, to show, to make men stand together naked or see one another naked, which shows essentially that someone thought of this and devised a particular procedure that was intended to humiliate, in particular, Arab men. In other words, there is thinking behind it. And you can see this after account after account after account. You don't simply see individual sadism, you see patterns. And they are absolutely obvious if you read one, two, three of these things. Now, the other day I was on a radio program on NPR, and they began with this little clip from Donald Rumsfeld from his press conference that day. And Donald Rumsfeld said something like, how many investigations have we had, General? He was talking to General Peter Pace, the Marine general who's the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and General Pace obligingly said, 7, 8, 9? And indeed, they have had a lot of investigations. But the interesting thing about all of these investigations, I mean, for those of you who are students of government or interested in seeing government at work, they show a remarkable bureaucratic mind, I think. Because if you look at each of the investigations, each one, I mean, think of torture of what we're talking about here is a chain. The people on the ground, the people who are actually doing this to detainee 7, the interrogators, the intelligence people gathering the information, the people who run the intelligence shop at Abu Ghraib, the people who run the prison, the in-country commander, and then back to the Secretary of Defense, the civilian officials in the Pentagon, up through Department of Justice, White House, and so on, a long chain. Each of these investigations has essentially looked at a couple of links in the chain. So you have the Taguba investigation, which looked at two links, the military police. You have Faye Jones, which looked at military intelligence. Each of them, none of the investigations, the broader point is, took a look at the entire chain and tried to determine what the political responsibility was of officials who actually decided what could be permitted and what couldn't be permitted during interrogations. Now, I want to revisit the case of detainee 7, because indeed his case was investigated. It was investigated specifically by Generals Fay and Jones. And indeed they went through his case, they went through the deposition. In October 2003, detainee 7 reported alleged multiple incidents of physical abuse. They suss out the actual dates, and they bark like a dog, being forced to crawl on his stomach, and basically they confirm all of it. There are four paragraphs here recounting what happened to detainee 7. They don't dispute any of it, basically confirm everything. And then an interesting thing happens in this report. General Fay comes to a conclusion in which he says he finds a circumstantial connection to military intelligence. Now, this detainee was what is called a military intelligence hold. That is, the military arrested him thinking he had intelligence to give to them, thinking he was a target who could indeed give them useful intelligence. General Fay says he finds a circumstantial connection to military intelligence, and he says, quote, military intelligence should have been aware of what was being done to this detainee. Now, I'd make a couple of points about this. First is that what was done to detainee 7 took place over 7, 8, 9 days during sessions lasting hours, sessions that left physical marks, including an ear mostly torn off, including a suppurating wound in the hand, left him unconscious, left him badly bruised, etc. And the presumption behind this report, at least the first presumption, is military intelligence came in later in the day, interviewed him, and had no idea what these other people were doing, which on its face is completely absurd. However, we don't have to look at it on its face. What we can do is look back at the words of detainee 7, and we discover that there is a line actually, it's the third line in the deposition. Then the interrogator came, and he was looking at me while they were beating me. In other words, military intelligence was there in the room watching. Now, General Fay does not say, well, we found no evidence of that. General Fay does not say, this is a calumny on military intelligence. General Fay does not say, that couldn't be true. General Fay simply ignores it, which means that the statement by Detainee 7 is basically stands uncontradicted, that indeed the intelligence officers were standing there watching him being beaten. And we find again and again, when you look at the individual cases, that intelligence people were watching. A third of the abuses that the Schlesinger report takes up, for example, happened during interrogation. Now, why am I harping on this? I'm harping on it because the strategy of the administration from the beginning has been intelligent, very bright, very effective, and very ruthless. The strategy is this. We have to sever the links between what happened on the ground and what's still happening on the ground and any notion of decision makers having anything to do with it. How do you do that? You cut the links between the military police and the actual interrogators, because when you get to the actual interrogators, you get to policy. When you get to policy, you get to policymakers. When you get to policymakers, you get to power. So the assumption behind their defense is that these people were acting alone. There's a problem with that, and it's not only lies in the deposition of Detainee 7 and many, many other depositions we've seen. The problem is we know it's not true. We have received, quite apart from these depositions, over the last year, a great many documents, some of them from the Department of Justice, some of them from the White House itself, and they tell us a couple of things. The first is that in the days after 9/11, there was a debate within the White House and within the Department of Defense in particular, as well as the State Department, about the Geneva Convention. Alberto Gonzalez, among others, argued that in this new paradigm, those are his words, of the war on terror, this new kind of war, the provisions of the Geneva Convention and the protections it offers prisoners of war were rendered obsolete. Quaint was his word. There was a big debate. General Colin Powell, among others, Secretary of State Colin Powell, argued that the United States must accord Geneva Convention protection to prisoners taken in the war on terror. It had always done so in the past, in all of its wars. It must continue to do so. But he also warned, by the way, that not only would withholding Geneva Convention protection put our soldiers at risk, and the military indeed holds this rather strictly, as you can imagine, he also argued that a decision to withhold that protection from prisoners would lead to the deterioration of good order and discipline in the military. And in both of these assumptions, particularly the second, he was proved right. However, he lost the debate, as he lost so many others, and the decision was made to withhold Geneva Convention protection from prisoners taken in Afghanistan. Techniques used on those prisoners then, according to former Secretary of Defense Schlesinger, who carried out one of these reports that bears his name, those techniques migrated, quote-unquote, to interrogations of prisoners taken in Iraq, where prisoners do enjoy, supposedly, the protections of the Geneva Convention. That was decision one. We have the record of that in full order. It's in this book. You can find it on the web. We have all of the memos and the decision directive that the president made. Second major decision was, the administration, after the beginning of the war on terror, after 9/11, when it decided, as it did decide, to take the gloves off, as counterterrorism official Kofor Black put it, the administration had a problem, which is that torture is illegal. The United States is signatory to the Convention on Torture, which forbids torture during time of war and any other time. There are domestic statutes, as Congressman Conyers knows well, forbidding torture. Torture is illegal. So what do you do in that situation? How do you order your people to use extreme interrogation techniques, that being the euphemism, and tell them also that they will not be subject to the law? How do you do that? Well, the administration had an answer. You redefine the word torture. What does torture mean anyway? What does the word mean? Well, The administration has a lot of smart lawyers in the Department of Justice, and they tasked them, as they say in government, to come up with a definition. Thus was born the notorious torture memo, also called the Bybee Memorandum after its author, that was written in, or at least completed in, August 2002. Now, that memo is very interesting for all kinds of reasons, but for our purposes here tonight, the reason I bring it up is because it redefined the word torture to mean those activities and those practices which cause pain so severe as to be equivalent to major organ failure or death. Now, if you think about that lovely definition for a minute, you'll realize that much of what I just read you about what happened to detainee 7 probably doesn't fit under that definition. It's probably not equivalent to major organ failure or death. So when you hear the president say, we do not condone torture, we follow the law, we do not torture, as he says repeatedly, you have to remember that he's using a particular and particularly nuanced use of that word. It's a nuanced use of that word that allows, for example, waterboarding. What is waterboarding? Well, I used to write about Latin America, Central America, and I knew this technique at the time by what Salvadorans, Argentines, Uruguayans call it, where it's a great favorite during the Dirty War. They called it El Submarino, the submarine. And what you do is you strip the prisoner, beat him up, usually, which is always a prelude to any of these things, and then you strap him down on a board facing the ceiling, face up, and you put a basin of water beneath his head. Usually that water is salt water, dirty water, urine, you know, something particularly fetid and disgusting. You ask a question, you beat him a little bit, and then you lift the board up and submerge his head underwater. And the liquid flows into the nostrils, it flows down the throat, and in fact, he drowns, basically. He loses consciousness. And the trick when you're the torturer to this, if you're a good torturer, is to lift him up before he actually dies. You want him basically to lose consciousness, but not to die. You do it, you revive him, slap him, hit him, whatever, and then do it again, and again, and again. And this was used by the Algerians by the French in the Algerian War in the late 50s. It was used, as I mentioned, by Argentines in the Dirty War, by the Brazilians. It's a great favorite around the world. And all of these people would be surprised to know that under the definition used by the U.S. government in that memorandum, this does not constitute torture. It constitutes something else. And in fact, if we're to believe the New York Times, and I hope we are, as of also August 2002, the Department of Justice issued a directive that explicitly gave permission to the intelligence agencies to use waterboarding. And we know that this has been used in Afghanistan, among other places. I believe I've used up my time. I hate to leave on this rather distressing note, although I found in talking about these issues that there is no way to leave on a happy note when you're talking, alas, about torture. I would leave you simply with the thought that we are left here with the burden of knowledge. That is, we know what's going on. We have the documents to prove it, not just the pictures to prove it. And the question is what we will do with that knowledge. Because the knowledge, in effect, is incriminating in itself. And I think that the citizens of this country are left with a decision about what kind of country we have. Are we a country that does not torture, or are we a country that tortures only when it needs to do so? I think as we sit here now, a year after these pictures were made public, we have to confirm the fact that the second possibility is, at least at this point, the truth. The United States does torture. And the question is what we as citizens can do to stop it. Thank you. Thank you for listening.